TR Radio from London, a bilingual radio to listen and think.
The program, co-hosted by myself, Andre Lopez Turner, and Juan Toledo, in association with extraradio1.com, Artifacto, and ztrradio.podomatic.com, welcomes via many different mediums Kendall Aiken into the studio to talk about one of his endeavors, which is he is a happiness coach and a tantra teacher. He has a background in philosophy and substance misuse, as well as tantra and happiness, and other things as well. So welcome, Kendall.
Hello, welcome.
Yeah, thank you for coming in. Happiness and tantra, let's go with happiness first. That's one of your, you know, your coaching, your counseling, your one of your many agendas. How do you go about this? What's your sort of over general philosophy on this?
Well, hello. Lovely hello. To speak to everybody today. And I was thinking today how the two of those two subjects link together, the tantra subject and the happiness subject. So I'm going to come to answer what you're asking there. Essentially, what they both link to and what the essence of happiness is about the self-awareness within yourself and the link to not letting your emotions be swayed by things which are outside of you. And the tantra's got the same link there, because it's about becoming really focused on how you're feeling, how sensitive you are to yourself, and how much you are able to cultivate your energetic focus.
Okay, so yeah, it's happiness and everything comes from within primarily.
Yes, it's what I'm not doing is trying to explain to people how to be happy by me choosing what it is for them to do to be happy. Essentially, what I'm doing is encouraging people to understand that their happiness is an inside job, that it comes from an internal experience, and I give clues, methods, processes as to how people can more easily contact their inner emotional GPS, as I sometimes call it, their ability to know when they are feeling better and know when they're feeling less good, and how to control that emotional scale.
Okay, and on the tantra side, I mean, I was in a retreat in India recently, and they talked about tantra very briefly because they do other stuff, but they said tantra is expansion and liberation, and most people in the West are obsessed about sex and get tantra completely wrong. These guys have, you know, degrees in yoga and philosophy and other things, and Indian.
Yeah, I think one of the things to say about tantra is it's extremely broad. It's been co-opted by the West in whatever way people in the West want to co-opt it. In the East, in India, where it derived, it has a much more clear version of what it is. Although I would say today, even in India, it's moved more towards, partially towards, a Western mentality. But essentially, in the West here, because it hasn't got a set definition, it's open to being anywhere between doing yoga positions and having no physical contact and not even necessarily bringing up sexual energy, right the way across the spectrum to the point of consensual orgies, which is often called red tantra, and the white tantra is where you don't really do any of the sexual stuff with other people. And what we run is essentially called pink tantra. It's a kind of halfway in the middle point where we're very focused on keeping the heart-centered spiritual element of it. But yeah, it's got a great diversity. So although they might say in the West it's like this, that's a bit of a generalization, because there are so many forms of it and so many different teachers and teachings.
Right. One?
Many aspects when we talk about happiness and the tantra has to do with renouncing to certain things, to let certain things go, seems to me, and probably rightly so, with the obsession we have here in the West with the I and with the accumulation of experience, accumulation of wealth, accumulation of air miles, many things, whatever. But I think always, for example, a philosopher like Schopenhauer, who always looked at the East, and he was the first Western philosopher to bring this concept of the East. And I just want to talk to you of the idea within the Tantra about the I as a construct, as a reality, social, physical, psychological, and Tantra. How are they related?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I would say that there is what we often say in Tantra is that it's a bridge between the body and spiritual, whereas many spiritual paths are looking to transcend the physical. In Tantra, you're looking to integrate the physical in the spiritual. So from that point of view, I would say that there probably is a place for the I. The I then is aiming to meet the spiritual experience. So you are not trying to deny the body in any way. You're not trying to get away from the body. Do you want to say a little bit more about how you're understanding the I? Or if I can be a bit clearer about the question, perhaps.
Well, the I, particularly in the way we conceive it here, I mean, in society, particularly in the West, again, it is something like, it's almost a construct, but it's a construct done of many factors. It's a construct of nature, nurture, education, aspirations, desires, and success. In many ways, and the capitalist society presents us with an idea of a successful or happy I. It's an I that manages to achieve as much as he or she wants, in a positive way. Let's keep it on the positive side. Yeah. But nevertheless, it's a construct. I think nevertheless, it's something that I just wonder. The problem with society is that it's very difficult to resign to move away from that I when it's so constant and present in our life. Yeah.
I kind of understand what you mean. And I suppose the bit I do understand is the paradoxical sense in which a lot of happiness, and here is where it crosses over into Tantra, has a lot to do with non-attachment. So it has a lot to do with not being, certainly in the happiness philosophy, has a lot to do with not being more happy because you've got £1 million in the bank, or less happy, that it's not relatable to how much money you've got or what objects you've got or what girlfriend you've got or so on and so forth. So it's one of the big things that I work with people in the happiness philosophy, is that a lot of people are held up, as it were, by their sense of status in society, what job they do, are they a husband, are they a father, and those things are very encouraging for people to feel good about themselves. The thing that I caution people against is that if you go down that route of being held up in your well-being and your happiness by the sense of status, for example, you have not really got a very clear control. I'd rather find another word rather than control. But you are not particularly in control of your happiness, because, of course, one day your children will leave, or your status in that job will end, or perhaps your money will end. So if you've been cultivating your feeling good in your life based on what you have or what status you have, you will likely find a point whereby you no longer can uphold it. And you can see this quite a lot with people who retire, who were quite confident and felt good about themselves, but then when they retire, they then don't quite know who they are, and they don't quite know how to feel good, and they can feel quite at a loss. And that's because they've constructed their reality. And this is, of course, a question which you very, you know, intelligently bring round to the question of I, because I is a construction of self, which we do in many different ways, but we are constructing a reality. And this is where, particularly in the happiness philosophy, on the deeper level, because it is worth pointing out here that to discuss the question of philosophy of happiness, there are many levels upon which we could discuss it. And it's a rather strange and interesting thing to talk on a radio, because you don't quite know who you're talking to. You know, I do know both of you, so I can talk to you, but I don't know what level the other people. So some people will find what I'm saying to be too low level, and some people will find it to be too high level. But essentially, you are dealing with construction of reality, and whether you're constructing the I of who I think I am, or whether you're constructing your sense of the fineness or okayness of the world, or of the okayness of yourself.
And if you look at the literature and cinema about this reinvention of the eye, the change in the people who find happiness, even in the more mediocre films and TV shows and even Pulp Fiction stuff, you always find an element of that. There's a huge chunk of literature which deals with that, which deals with the reinvention of the eye, to reconstruct the eye in a different way in order to find happiness.
Yeah, I mean, I'm slightly stumbling on that to find happiness, because the way I view happiness is that it's always existent. It's a bit like the sunshine in the sky during the day, of course, and the clouds are our thoughts, or particularly our critical thinking, which cover over the happiness that is always there. So it's not so much to find it as to move the parts out of the way that stop it from coming through. And I think the way in which I would totally agree with you in literature and in films, and I like that element that bring forward the idea that we are a construction of ourselves, is the way in which, and this crosses over into Tantra, the way in which it's a practice about coming into your present moment, and in that present moment looking for the appreciation of what you have in the now. Now, in the present moment, we don't have the history story of who I've been through my life, and we don't have the construct of who I'm going to be or where I'm going. We also move away from things like status or how much money I've got. If you can really come into your present moment more and more, you become someone almost who doesn't have a name as well. So you are deconstructing the I quite a lot. Of course, it's still the I of me who's doing coming into the moment of now. So in a way, you can never get away from it, and therefore you're caught in a paradox that you are, the I is attempting to move away from the I, if that doesn't sound too philosophical and paradoxical. But essentially, that is kind of what's happening. You are coming into the moment of now, and in the moment of now, attempting to choose who you are and what you want to feel. More what you want to feel and what you want to focus on.
This is fascinating, because I'm also interested in the we and the one. And sometimes you hear that too much of the I is self-absorbed and can also be a dangerous place to be and a selfish place to be, and away from the we. You know, we humans, we society, we group, this kind of thing, yeah? How do we navigate some this kind of stuff? I'm almost inclined to actually go, you know what, should we just move on to how you actually work with someone who comes to you? But I'm just throwing that in there. And then the other line, another line that I like from an actual band, actually, I think it corresponds maybe to what you're saying, is, you know, you get away from yourself, free yourself from yourself. You're standing in the way of, I think is what you're saying, because you're talking about really an internal job all the time.
Yeah, it's very
internal.
It's an internal job, and it's about deciding where you put your focus. So focus is a really big word. To come back to the we thing, I've been quite interested, you know, we were talking about films just before. I was quite interested to listen to Jim Carrey lately, who's a very interesting chap, I think, actually, especially, you know, with his painting, but also his philosophy lately has been, well, certainly what I've caught up with lately has been interesting. And someone said to him, I like your spirit, man, talking about his soul, or I like your soul. And he said to them, what makes you think I've got a soul and that we are not just all soul? And I kind of liked that idea, because certainly our literature and our films and stuff do tell us the narrative that we've all got individual souls. But I find it a very interesting idea. And this obviously comes into my own personal philosophies about life and afterlife. But afterlife, I tend to think of it as like the sea. And that we're a stream at the moment, so we're still water, but we're a sort of subsection. We filtered off into this small part, and we will return to the sea, the big, endless, boundless sea, if that's possible to have a boundless sea. But in that theory, we are returning to what I would call source, or source energy, or the sea. And in that sea, you're no longer derived in your various streams. You are part of this greater stream. So one of the things which I think is fascinating already in this conversation is the way in which we get to see that we have all been fed narratives throughout our cultural understanding of what we're living, i.e. the society around us, how well that society's going, and who we are and where we come from, and many other questions. But I think those four are very interesting, because it's very, very easy for us to play a game whereby we think we all understand the same construct because it's part of our social construct. So the construct of we are a soul and when we die we will return to our essence or our soul, and that's a unique individual thing. Well, that, you know, the Jim Carrey comment reminded me, yeah, but that also is potentially a construct that I've been fed. So I'm aware that I've got to be a little bit careful about falling into social norms simply because they're accepted. And I suppose I do enjoy considering what social norms are there and being able to see if I can go beyond, in a sense. And I would say that a lot of the happiness philosophy, particularly, it's not new in the sense that it's been around a long time, but it is kind of thinking out of the box. And by that I mean it's deciding that you construct how you want to feel all the time about everything. So somebody might come along saying, isn't the world in a terrible state? You know, the environment's in a terrible state, or Donald Trump, or, you know, the world, the countries are fighting, and, you know, there's economic control, and there's, you know, new world slavery and all sorts. You can say that and say, isn't this terrible? And somebody who's really practicing the happiness philosophy will say, no, not at all. Not unless I choose to see it as terrible. So you're very much taking your own choice of, first of all, what you look at, which is called focus, And secondly, how you choose to feel about everything that you're looking at. So I'll leave it there just for the moment, because there's a lot of kind of philosophical layers on top of
that. There is. I mean, I was going to say, some people's, or some think, some happiness can be built off other people's misery, possibly. You know, you could say the American materialism is often built on the sort of taking the resources of other people. I mean, there's all this kind of stuff. And maybe if we were an Eastern Ghouta being, you know, hailed with a lot of bombs, it would be, could be difficult to sort of go.
But I want to mention a kind of a precedent that exists about that approach. And the precedent happens in the 17th century. And there was this great philosopher called Leibniz, who was a major intellect. He was the inventor of calculus and integral calculus, and also he was a philosopher. And a great mathematician, but also a philosopher. And he had a public philosophy and a private philosophy. His public philosophy was very positive. And he talked about this being the best of all possible worlds in a very chirpy, positive way. And he was lampooned by a French writer called Voltaire, who wrote a book called Candide. And Candide is a person who basically witnesses huge amounts of catastrophes, but he continues saying this is the best of all possible worlds. The thing that changed the minds of the people at that time was an earthquake. It's to do with theology and the presence of God. It was about the earthquake in Lisbon in the 1750s, 52, the 1753. I don't remember the exact year, but it's about that time. And the question is like, oh my God, how can God exist if he brings so much misery into the world? But what you got is taken, that is about this idea of how I react to the world. So it was lampooned already, but it was lampooned in a kind of very Western, very I sort of things. You are talking about in a more collective way. I can see the differences. But some of the things that you have said is part of the argument, at least in philosophical terms.
I mean, what I'm interested in, I think, is an individual experience. You know, I've got a philosophy degree, and I, you know, do philosophize at times, but I'm probably less interested. Actually, you sound far more knowledgeable than me, by the way, Juan. But I feel like I'm I'm not as interested in the philosophy as the result. I'm more interested in the experience of living, and my consciousness. My awareness is that I want to learn how to live as much of my experience here as a human being in the most amount of genuine happiness that I can. Now, that doesn't say I won't have some experiences which dip me down under being happy, like today when my daughter threw juice on my laptop. I went through a period of being really pissed off because I thought my laptop was broken. I then realized that it's still alive and there was no need for me to get really pissed off. And there was a great learning in there for me, because without those opportunities, I don't get to test out my philosophy. However, the thing is really about saying, yes, I can construct dialogues which find it intellectually interesting or not, or I can take part in a much more practical, physical game which has real-time results to it. You know, I used to be someone who would spend many years, many days, as Andre knows as well, you know, debating many points of philosophy, of world affairs. I'm still, you know, interested in that, but I'm far less attached to, and there's the word attached to being frustrated by a situation or the world or a conversation or a philosophical debate. I'm far more interested in finding a way through all the debates to remain in a healthy state of well-being. But partly 99% of that is because I like it, because I enjoy feeling good. There's the 1%, which is also because it's important to me to be part of this collective of the world who is role modeling the way in which we don't all have to be swept up into a wave of disaster theorizing or feeling bad. I don't know if I'm putting those percentages in a helpful way or not, but essentially my vast majority of why I do it is because I've worked out a way that it worked, and I don't want to sound like the first person who's done this, by the way, but it works what I do, and it works what you coach, you know.
I know, which means I think we need to come on to that now, which is, how do you go about this? So what is your sort of methodology or steps or processes or whatever word we want to talk about, yeah?
Okay, so we're going to have to talk fairly generally here because it's probably easier in some ways to have an individual example. Mm. If we do that, we'll probably take one of you two, and that might end up a little bit over personal, maybe. Yeah. So the original part of it, you see, it's called health and happiness coaching because it's so important to not leave out the body. It's so important to, in fact, begin with the body. And by that I mean, if you are, you know, Andre, you and I know each other from the drugs world, not taking drugs as much as working with people who take or try and stop taking drugs. We're both group leaders from rehabs back in London. And we know that if you try and rationalize with someone who's on drugs, it's very difficult to do. You basically first got to stabilize those people so that they're on some sort of even ground, so that they know where they're standing, they know where their head is as well, before trying to have any kind of real sensible conversation with them. So the same is true for all of us. We're all at different levels, but food is probably where I start. You know, the sense of our nutrition. If we're drinking every night alcohol, 2 or 3 glasses, in order for us to get into a steady space, we first got to sort of reduce that down to a level whereby we can actually take part in a conversation where we'll hear someone. If our food intake is McShit every night, you know, our chemical compound is going to be so depleted, very likely at least, that we will end up feeling as though we've got pains in our bodies, and these are taking a lot of our mental capacity away because we're trying to deal with not feeling great to start with. So in order to start really having a conversation about how to be happier, we've kind of got to get onto a stable platform to be able to begin. So the basis of the health part of it is where I do a 10-week program, which is my most popular program, and it begins with the first 3 weeks is nutrition. So the mantra is eat well, sleep well, do regular exercise. The second week is relaxation and sleeping, because sleeping is one of the very underrated importances to physical well-being and therefore mental well-being. And then regular exercise, the third one, which makes such a big difference to the first two. Like it really aids your ability to eat well and to sleep well if you're doing regular exercise. So once you get onto a certain level of those three, then you're ready to start taking part in the psychological side of it. But let me not underestimate those first three.
No.
You know, they're pretty important and really challenging to be able to get yourself, if you've been following a pattern of regular McDonald's, to move yourself to healthy food that you're cooking for yourself and you know what's in the ingredients of it and you're doing research about what the effects of that food is. That's a big leap.
Yeah. Well, you know, we're talking about glycemic uptake and sugar and processed foods and how it, you know, enters the bloodstream very quickly and gives you a spike, i.e. crack or cocaine, and how so it hits your emotions, it takes you down. I mean, absolutely, you could never underestimate that. So you go nutrition, exercise, sleep. So you sorry to interrupt there.
It's really important to I'm just writing some articles at the moment about the way in which you have momentum and the importance of momentum. And with you can see this with the psychological side, but you can see it also with the physical side, that if you don't do any exercise and it's normal for you to do no exercise, you obviously don't just start running 20 miles a day. You just walk to the corner, you know, you just start building up that momentum, because your momentum's very still, it's very slow. In fact, your momentum could be in reverse. You could be getting heavier and heavier and less able to breathe well, and your momentum is always moving. There's no such thing as a still point with momentum. Mm-hmm. In balance, you're always either moving towards better health or away from better health, towards more happiness or away from more happiness. And like anything, like learning to run, you know, if you are running five times a week, you will find that you are consistently getting fitter. You know, that's essentially what momentum is. It's the idea that something's getting easier as you practice it more. And you've got this same state with the psychological side of it. At first, it's challenging because it's not what most people do. And what I mean by that is, you hear a lot about mindfulness, and for a lot of people, being mindful is a very challenging thing to do on its own. But with the happiness philosophy, the mindfulness is the beginning step. And what that means is, it's about sitting, becoming aware of who you are in your patterns of thought, particularly. So you start becoming aware of what your thought patterns are, which sounds a little bit strange, because it's an interesting that we brought up the question of the I earlier. Mm-hmm. Because this is almost like the I watching the I. It's the witness of ourselves, and we're attempting to do that non-judgmentally, because another thing which we're prone to do is to watch ourselves with high levels of judgment about whether we are doing it right, advanced enough, angry about what we're doing. And this actually crosses over quite strongly, if I can, this doesn't overcomplicate stuff, is with the Tantra side. Because in the Tantra, you're very much doing a similar thing. You are becoming conscious of who you are, and you're trying not to fill, or you're certainly practicing not filling that space with shame. So you're becoming non-shameful with the reality of who you are. In Tantra, you're doing it quite a lot, first of all, with your body, say, with your nudity, so that you can take off your clothes, or this is one element of the Tantra, and go, I'm aware that I would normally say that I've got thin legs, or, you know, whatever, you know, kind of big, whatever it is, you know, and you can be quite critical. We can all be fairly critical of our own bodies, partly to do with the media and the way we're presented with images of who we're supposed to be, but for lots of different reasons. So it's about, in Tantra, it's about saying, I'm accepting of myself. I'm going to be conscious of what the thoughts and the sentences are that are coming to me, which are critical, and I'm going to learn to be okay with, let's begin with my body. I'm going to learn to be okay with that. And the happiness philosophy is similar. You are first of all starting to look at yourself, look at your thought processes, and to start being interested without being
judgmental.
Well, negatively critical, yeah, because yes, judgmental in a negative sense, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let's just move this on, because we've got like 15 minutes type of thing. So it's, yeah, I know you're going. So we go there, yeah, and then we go where? Because we're wanting to convert the body into a good place and the mind into a good place. So we're talking about discipline, structure, health, and then awareness.
Yep.
Yeah. So, and then change, I presume, here. I mean, I don't know what week we're on here, maybe five or.
Yeah.
I'm listening.
Because you take a couple of weeks to do the
mindfulness,
self-awareness practice. And it's so different for different clients, you know. So we are really talking general. One of the things which.
Yeah, we are talking general.
I might do at this point with some clients. It depends which ones. But if somebody, say, has come to me with a sense that they're not really discovering a sense of joy in themselves, one of the things I might do at this stage, so in week 6 or week 7, is ask them to start doing what I call the happiness walk, which is when they are out in having a walk somewhere, or they choose to go out for a walk, they really embody playing the role of someone whose body is extremely alive, like an athlete or a dancer. And as they walk with that bounce in their step, they breathe deeply, they have a sense of, I'm going to play the part of an extremely energetic, happy person, full of well-being and strength and agility. So they're just playing it for a short period, 100 meters, something like that, in their stride, in their body shape, and in their experience, just for a short time. And that allows them to have some sort of anchor which they can recognize as their ability to switch quite quickly from a place which feels neutral or doesn't feel that great. And this is not the actual method, but what that is used for is in order for them to say, oh, I can actually recognize how quickly I could potentially move from a place of not feeling great into a place which is available to me all the time. So to get more into the nitty-gritty of how you would go about doing that, you essentially start choosing to look at the parts which you can see that feel good. So you start sifting through your life and recognizing, I mean, this is the beginning part for as a general sense, is you go general, you generally look at the parts of your life which you find are really difficult to look at and still feel good about. So if every time you look at Syria and start reading about Syria, you find it churns you up and that's really difficult, you start just noticing that and saying, okay, for a while, until I've got the art of this, I'm not going to look at that area. If you find that when you talk to your parents, it becomes really argumentative and that's difficult, for a while you stay away from there. But essentially you start looking towards the areas that are easy to tune in to feeling good. So you go and walk in Hampstead Heath, or you find a flower that you particularly like, or you sit down and you lie relaxed and you indulge yourself in your bath for a while, really enjoying it. And you first of all start making those experiences more of the experiences that are filling your life. And that's perhaps the beginning stage, because again, that's a bit like the happiness walk. That's starting to bring your awareness around to the way in which you have a lot of potential to decide how you feel depending on what you look at. And the next stage would then be how you look at it. So it is possible to end up in a much further stage than this, looking at something which other people would find shocking and horrendous, like let's take Syria, and still feel good as you do it, so that you don't get sucked into the whirlpool of angry feelings that you once did. Now that's quite a lot more advanced. You need to go step by step in order to get there, but essentially it's showing you that you can do that, you can get to that place. And part of it would be, again, that kind of original Buddhist concept of non-attachment, but it's certainly not Buddhism on its own. It's got a lot more elements than Buddhism.
I presume that with different clients you've got different techniques, but there might be things that you apply all the time, breathing and those kind of mundane things that bring pleasure to you or to anybody, you know, exactly. A long bath, a long walk, etc., which is very interesting. So it's point to 18. happiness with these mundane things that make you feel good about yourself or about the world. I want to talk to you about the time factor. And the time factor, bring with what Andre was talking of, the we, and the time factor of the now, the importance of the now, more than the importance of the past or the importance of the future. And this idea that you need to enjoy the moment as it is, the carpe diem,
yeah,
you know, philosophy, if you want. But do you play, do you have any methods, any techniques about bringing that element of the now, that the important things, the happiness starts in these moments? And since we live in the present constantly, the now is essential.
So I need to understand your question.
The question is, do you bring any techniques dealing with time, like, for example,
to
memory,
to
get into the now, to get into the good moment of the now?
Well, one of the things which I'm just remembering, one of the clients I had a month or two ago, and he would be very, very good at supporting his wife. So his kind of feeling good, I mean, he had lost feeling good quite a lot, but his sense of feeling good was doing stuff for his wife who was slightly disabled, and he would go and solve stuff all the time. So he would go and mend things in the house, and continually moving, you know, continually doing the next thing, the next thing, the next thing. And he was getting a low level of satisfaction from doing this, but he had a questioning sense that he was really trying to, he was avoiding things actually. So when we started working together, he came to the conclusion through the coaching that that's exactly what he was doing, that he had been doing that for 30 years, avoiding really being with himself. So I set him the challenge each week to sit for, I can't remember how long it was, I think for 20 minutes, whatever was comfortable for him, and look out the window and look at his garden and start noticing with wonder. And it was looking at the birds and seeing their patterns of movement. It was looking at the leaves and looking at the color change. It was looking at the rain and watching it land on the ground. Now, when he first started doing it, he said to me, you know, I looked out that window and all I could see that the shed needed repairing, and the you know, I needed to put some more plants in the garden. And after a while, he started to recognize that that's what he was doing, and that's not what the process, it was fine for him to do that to begin with, but he got better and better at being able to just be amazed and to be in the wonder of the moment. And this was very important because it was also to do with the question of focus. It was him bringing his focus to what essentially is there all the time, the wonder of the world we live in, and the ability to come into contact with that without too much a doing of anything. It's more of the moving away from the critical and the unpleasant experiences and the avoidance that he had been involved with for a long time.
That came across to me as well as sort of, I think I got as a sense of to sit there and just to observe. Which is possibly, you know, what they say, be a witness, observe, with no intervention and no action.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And a sense of appreciation.
Well,
pardon me? You see, the bit we haven't come on to yet is the real key to being able to ramp up your emotional level is in the word appreciation. So, but what we've been talking about so far is how to get to a place where you're not too affected by your old patterns, your negative patterns of the way you look at stuff, because a lot of us are involved in negative patterns both of eating, sleeping, and exercise. Well, it depends who you are, because some individuals do it brilliantly, but a lot of us can be in negative patterns which we're not even aware of. Then psychologically we can be involved in negative patterns which are to do with being critical. Critical thinking essentially draws your emotions down. And I'm not talking about critical thinking as in critiquing something. That's different. What I'm talking about is criticizing either yourself or others or something that's happening in the world. When you're doing that, you're essentially drawing your emotional level downwards. Now, if you're interested in the happiness philosophy, and let's just say not everyone is, some people would rather feel pissed off but feel as though that was honest to themselves in terms of how what the state of the world that they see is. You know, for those people, it's more important to have that sense of their honesty or whatever they may call that than it is to feel good. And I'm not here to judge them. I'm just somebody who's interested, more interested in my own feeling good than I am in feeling that I have some sense of truth or honesty about the world, because I'm somebody who believes that truth is really constructed by me rather than constructed by the state of the world. So where you really build these levels of feeling good is through the art of appreciation. It is through starting to, first of all, witness this garden just as it is, and then starting to practice the wow. The wow, isn't it amazing? Do I not so appreciate the way that the birds have this ability to fly? You know, isn't it incredible? Aren't I amazed? Aren't I appreciative of the way in which the birds come and take the worms? The worms then are not in my garden. You know, I'm watching something that I didn't see before, and I'm starting to focus on bits that feel really good about it. If I can see bits which are feeling good, then I milk them. I see them again. I repeat that. I get into the sense of appreciation, and there I then can start building and constructing a world which only looks at the bits which find greatest appreciation. And then I start filling my world with as much appreciation as I choose to fill it with.
Yeah, you remind me of that dictum of the forgotten miracle of being alive. You know, this idea that we need to live in a state of wonder. We should live in a state of wonder just by the mere fact that we are alive. Yeah.
Beautiful. I love that idea.
Yeah.
And you reminded me then of watching certain sports. Our listeners can't see your daughter here.
Yes, wonderful. River.
Hello. Certain sports. I mean, you know, I watch a lot of professional surfing and snowboarding, yeah, and stuff, and then you watch football. And the appreciation of most surfers and snowboarders, yeah, and skateboarders, it's like, you know, I'm Andre, I lost to Juan and Kendall today, and man, they ripped. They, yeah, were amazing. And then you pan to football and you watch it. It's a great game, marvelous game. Sometimes, you know, the loser can lose, but they played brilliantly.
Yeah.
And you get the managers and the players, and they are bitter and negative and nasty. You know, they could actually never say, you know what, Manchester United was superb today,
yeah,
and they beat us 2-1. You know, do you know what I'm saying?
Great, so, I think you're showing a great example of that. That's exactly the point.
And yeah, you know,
but because the competition is business, it's an industry, so yeah.
Well, but it's also a lack of appreciation, yeah, of the actual game, yeah, and the other people you're playing against. First of all, exactly, you wouldn't have the game if you two weren't playing against me, say.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a lack of appreciation there, and then a lack of appreciation that the other people were also very good. I mean, and then pegging it back to an appreciation of life. I mean, I was with someone the other day who's particularly happy and jovial. I said, I pointed them out to them. I said, that's great. And she said, well, you know, as soon as I wake up, I thank God that I'm breathing, and then I play some gospel music. And
I mean,
I just thought, hey, this is superb. You know,
it's about focus, and I think your example is really nice there, because you know the managers and people have got critical thinking going on, and they're not feeling good at that moment that they've lost. And you're very right in that they could very easily, and you're showing a fantastic example of it. They could turn around and go, wow, they just, the opposition just played fantastically today. You know, I was amazed at the fluidity of their playing and the way in which the players just worked as a team. But they don't say that because they're in the game of keeping a critical thought about loss. And that's the game they've chosen to play. I don't want to be critical of them being critical, if you know what I mean. It's yeah. it's the choice of each it. It's the individual who's choosing to live in the way they choose to live. All I'm doing is saying, of all the things I can do in my life, I would like to spend as much of the time I've got alive in feeling as good as I can. And it totally is about regular appreciation. The latest articles I've been writing have been about the way in which, if we can create a daily pattern of behaviors, particularly, and I'm particularly using those eat well, sleep well, do regular exercise, but I wake up in the morning, I do exercises, and as I'm doing them, I am thinking, wow, I'm so appreciative of my body still working. You know, I'm sitting, and then I do meditation, and before I get into no mind meditation, I'm doing an appreciation for being alive, for this day, for my wife, for my child, for the house I live in, for the fact there's food. I'm doing appreciation for anything I can find, and I'm building that emotion in me. So when I begin my day, I've already set my emotional tone, and my emotional tone's already pretty good. It's quite hard to knock me off because I'm already feeling charged up with appreciation. And if I keep on adding to that through the day, it's pretty difficult to knock me off, you know. And I finish my day with the same thing. So before I go to bed, I'm also praising my body, my amazing wellness. I'm doing exercise, I'm doing meditations. And I'm bookending every single day of my life with that now.
Yeah.
And believe me, just doing the short regularity of appreciation has a massive impact on all our lives, you know.
I got a final question for you, Kendall, because I find very positive what you're saying. And I almost think of the possibility of positive emotion as a way of social revolution, almost in certain ways.
I agree. I think there's a wave of, I mean, of course, people like to see a wave all the time. You like to feel as though we're part of something new. And, you know, at the end of the day, the great thing about what I do with happiness is that it doesn't really matter what other people think of me. You know, there's plenty of people who think that I've, you know, lost the plot, or you know, that I'm over positive about things, or they really don't. There are plenty of people who don't get it.
Yeah, but the thing I was thinking about, in order to make it practical, well, not practical, because obviously it is practical. It's practical for the individuals, but in a certain way, in a universal way, almost. Let's say universal on the we, on the kind of in the social conscience that we have. Well, I don't know. I think that, not that you need to, but I would imagine that there's an element in which you need to accommodate the political needs to be accommodated into it. And I'm not talking about the political as the war in Syria or anything like that. I'm talking about the political of the mundane daily life of politics, the sense of injustice at the job, the sense of not being paid enough, that kind of thing, bad job. These kind of elements, how do you accommodate those?
I'm going to slightly disagree with you there, I think, because I think what the aim really is, from my point of view, is I do it myself. I role model that as much as I can. Other people may talk to me. I feel like the best thing that we can all do in our lives is, you know, that old phrase of be the change you want to see in the world. Be that person, live that life. And this is the choice for me. Your choice may be to go and demonstrate somewhere or to go and make political change. That's your choice. So you've got a different level of importance in your life. Yeah. Your level of importance is not about being the happiest you can be. It's about making the biggest change or whatever way that is for you. That's your choice. For me, I coach people. I run groups in Tantra and other things, and it allows me to reach as many people who want that kind of lifestyle. But it's not for me so much to go and campaign for it as much as to demonstrate it through role modeling being that way. And anybody who's interested, I love to talk to people about it. I love to share it. I love to, anybody who wants to do coaching and is struggling with the money side, I love to do it anyway. you know, it's not about the money for me. It's about being part of what you talked about just before, a wave of change. But it's really important that I'm not feeling too connected to that wave of change. If the change comes, that's great. I will look for appreciation in that. If it doesn't, I'm going to be okay as well, because the thing I'm doing is focusing on what I can appreciate, and it's not needing the world to be a different way in order for me to feel good.
Cool. Well, look, hey, look, we have to round this up. So thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you so much, Kendall.
That's and brilliant. how do people get a hold of you? Obviously, this has been live, and then it'll be podcasted, etc. So how do people get a hold of you?
Can I give my phone number?
Yeah. Do you give your phone number or website address, whatever? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, on our Tantra, we're on freedombridge.co.uk.
Freedom Bridge.
All one word, freedombridge.co.uk. If you want to do coaching, the easiest way, the most direct way, is just to call me. It's 079-44-883-961.
Okay.
079-44-883-961. And essentially, we can coach and Skype from around the world. So anybody who speaks English, we can work with people. And we love doing it, both me and my wife. My wife is also a Tantra teacher and psychosexual coach. So yeah, this is what we love doing. And you know, I've got high appreciation for anyone who shows an interest, because you know, to me, there's nothing more important than living a life where we're inspiring other people to be happy while we're being happy ourselves.
Are you I know, you know, you speak pretty good Spanish as well. Yeah, are you up for that? This is a bilingual.
Pienso que no puedo hacerlo en español todavía.
There you are. Oh, you got to start somewhere. Muy bueno, seguro que sí.
Okay, okay. Well, hey, thank you very much, Kendall. And on behalf of extraradio1.com and ztrradio.podomatic.com and Artifacto, see you all next time and next week.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Speak again, my friend. Take care.
Thank you, Kendall. Bye-bye.
Adios.
Adios.
Septia Radio. From London. A bilingual radio. To listen and think.